It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Ahead of spring bird migration, we learn how laser technology to deter birds may help prevent avian influenza viruses from spreading from wild birds to domestic poultry flocks. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Craig Dewar is regional sales lead for the Bird Control Group. Craig, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thank you for having me.
So your laser system is operating now on some Wisconsin dairy farms. Can you explain the application of lasers in that setting, you know, farms without poultry?
Yes. Excuse me. So we had branched out from the normal, what we were doing many years ago from the agricultural. We brought it into the other side of the dairy, the aquaculture and so forth, and the poultry farms. We found that we were able to move the birds, mainly usually starlings and pigeons you're going to find in these dairy barns. We were able to move those birds out of there with our laser. And as we program it to run different types of patterns throughout the barn, and the birds see that laser as a threat coming in there to harm them. So they just want to leave the area where that laser is deployed.
And so how would that system then compare to what you have been deploying for poultry farms?
It's the same system, just using it in a different sense or different setting. We put the lasers on the outside of the poultry farms, mount them on their barns, and then we program it to cover a certain area, the rooftops of the barns, in between the alleyways of the barns, and in some cases the surrounding fields that are adjacent to the barns and the farms.
So how do lasers work in warding off birds? What's going on?
So when we see, as humans, we see a green dot when it's moving through an area in the daylight hours, the birds are seeing a whole beam, like a lightsaber, if you will. And as it is moving, we just put different patterns in there to move throughout an area that we're asked to cover. So they're seeing that from a great distance. And they see it as a threat, like a stick coming at them or a predator moving in. The object is just to move it slow through the area. And as they see that, they just want to avoid the area altogether. So it does a great job in at least doing that.
And laser light, I think it comes in a variety of colors. What is best for deterring birds?
In all of our studies, this laser was developed. It's a class 3B laser. It was developed in 2012 in the Netherlands. We are now on our second generation that came out in 2019. And we found that green is the brightest spectrum of light that the bird's seeing. We have used red. We've used other colors as well. But we found through all of our studies that green is what they see best. And so that associates danger as it comes through there. When it's being ran.
And do all birds react the same to these lasers?
In most of our studies, yes. There are a couple of birds that we've dealt with throughout the years that just don't react to it at all, and it doesn't harm them. It doesn't affect them, I should say, excuse me. So one of those is a woodpecker, and we have no idea why.
Craig Dewar is with us, regional sales lead for the Bird Control Group, as we talk about warding off birds on poultry farms and the impact of that. You can join in questions and comments at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Craig, how many lasers do you need per farm to be effective at deterring these wild birds?
It's based on the farm size, how many barns you have, and how the barns are laid out. But realistically, in most cases, anywhere between 2 to 6 lasers, again, depending on the layout of the farm.
Is it known? Do the lasers cause any distress in the birds? Are they harmed at all through this technology?
They are not. The object is to just move it slowly through the area and let the birds see it as a threat, and they're already leaving the area or won't even be in the area at that point. But we are doing a lot of studies with Purdue University. We did some studies over in the UK with another university, and we are currently trying to get some studies done with Minnesota University, which is the main poultry producer for turkeys in the US, so we can have more data. But currently the data we have shows that it does not harm them at all.
And you mentioned Minnesota, which is offering farms up to $10,000 in grants to install these lasers. Do you know how effective the lasers are at deterring migratory birds?
We started this program 2 years ago with a very well-known company up in Minnesota. And prior to that, those farms had had outbreaks of the avian influenza. And once we put these lasers on the farms that they had asked us to that have been hit before, after that, we have not seen one of those farms have any outbreaks in the 2 years we've had the lasers on their farms. Mm. That's the data we have. That's why we're looking to the University of Minnesota and working with Minnesota Turkey Growers Association to help get more studies in and have a better understanding of just exactly how this is working and how it's affecting the poultry industry and keeping the birds away.
Let's take a call now. Kevin in Janesville is here. Hi, Kevin. What is your question?
Hi. I was wondering if this system would be effective against predatory species, for instance, bald eagles or ospreys hanging around fish hatcheries. Could this keep the predators from attacking the fingerlings in the ponds? Thank you.
Yeah, very, very good question, Kevin. Yes, we are actually in the aquaculture industry. We've got several lasers on catfish farms down in the Louisiana area. We've now went over to the shrimp industry, and we're working in the oyster industry. So yes, it does work on the ospreys. The eagles, we're still in a trial period with those and some other predator birds like your falcons and hawks. We're doing a study currently in Kentucky on a free range chicken farm because they're just losing so many birds through the predator birds that we are doing a study there. So we should have that data within the next couple of months. But to answer your question, yes, it does work in the aquaculture industry.
Do birds grow accustomed to these laser deterrents over time?
Very good question. No, they do not. There is no habituation, because with our laser, we never run the same pattern twice. So the birds are not able to figure out which way that laser is going to move next. And with the amount of patterns and waypoints we can put in there, it's so many that they just don't even understand how it works and where it's going to be next. So they do not get used to it. No.
Craig, as we go out here, what is still a mystery about the capabilities with lasers and birds? Like, how do you build on the laser system you have?
Currently we're working. We've got a prototype for our generation 3. We're basically listening to the consumer and the end user of what they would like in the laser. Some things are going to be to where we can use Wi-Fi with it and actually be able to see the laser from your laptop at your desk. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the things that we're trying to improve based off of consumer wants.
Craig, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Craig Dewar is Regional Sales Lead for the Bird Control Group, and we continue this conversation about protecting poultry flocks from avian flu. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The spring migratory period for wild birds brings an increased risk of bird flu infection to all poultry flocks. The state agriculture department recommends that farmers use the strongest biosecurity measures to protect their birds. Call in with a question. You can share thoughts, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Ron Kane is a poultry specialist at UW Extension's College of Agricultural and Life Sciences. Ron, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks for having me.
So the State Ag Department reporting the last local outbreak of disease-causing avian influenza was in January. How dangerous is avian flu this year compared to previous years?
Yeah, probably still pretty similar as far as we know. I think it's still pretty prevalent in the wild bird populations. So I have to think a similar risk from the last couple of years.
And the state says migratory birds in springtime create an increased risk of infection for poultry flocks. How big of a threat are migratory birds for spreading avian flu?
Yeah, they certainly are carrying it. A lot of the wild waterfowl, especially, we think. And so as they move through, you know, they leave their droppings and those can spread the virus.
Why would migratory birds travel to poultry farms?
That's a great question. I think I don't know that they specifically do, but if there is any water nearby, then they are probably attracted to those areas. Also, it seems probably, you know, some of the crop fields around those facilities might have spent grain and things like that.
Okay. And can you kind of explain the reporting and communication mechanisms for an avian flu outbreak and how quickly it can be suppressed?
Yeah. So if a producer notices an increase in mortality, generally they will either contact their veterinarian or the state Department of Agriculture, and samples get sent to the diagnostic lab here in Madison usually. They can turn those samples over usually within a day at most, and they'll know if there's a presumptive positive. Officially, they have to go to Iowa State to get official
Guy
confirmation.
Smith, can you hear me? Good morning. Yes, I
can. I'm sorry, we're having just a little bit of technical difficulty here. Just one moment. I think we can hear. All right, carry on there. So normally for testing, you would need to go to Iowa State, you said?
So that's the official national lab. So they get the official confirmation, but our state lab here probably knows pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, at that time, both the State Department of Agriculture and USDA would be called in. They'll quarantine the farm, and usually they'll try to depopulate that farm as quickly as possible, hopefully within 24 to 48 hours, ideally, because we'd like to not let that virus spread any beyond that farm.
Is there any other way of controlling an outbreak besides, you know, euthanizing an entire flock?
Right. at this time, that's the government system, is to totally depopulate. And really, from what I know of this virus, most of those birds are probably going to die anyway, so it's pretty nasty. There is talk of vaccination. France has started vaccinating flocks. There's a lot of political angles to that, but
what
maybe
do you mean
in the future?
What do you mean by that?
So right now, most governments, if a country starts vaccinating for influenza, most of the other countries will immediately stop any imports from that country. Hmm. So, you know, poultry exports are a huge business for us here in the U.S., and to lose all of that is pretty expensive, so that becomes a political issue.
We're talking about avian flu and how to contain it with Ron Kane, UW Extension poultry specialist. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Ron, earlier we heard from Craig Dewar at Bird Control Group about the use of lasers to ward off wild birds from farm operations. What do you make of that type of technology?
Yeah, I think it's a great idea. It seems to be working well from what, you know, he reported and other things I've seen. I think, again, keeping the wild birds away from our domestic birds seems to be a big part of biosecurity. So I think it's good.
What biosecurity measures have the greatest effects on stopping the spread of bird flu?
Yeah, that's a good question. There's, you know, we do the typical things like trying to change clothes before going into barns, not allowing anything in the barns, and yet that doesn't seem to have solved the problem. There's been some studies with outbreak cases where maybe trucks coming on the farm are tracking it to the farm, things like that, but I think there's still some debate. There's some debate whether it travels in the air on dust particles as well.
Oh, that's interesting. Are there risks in taking poultry to and from market in the spread of avian flu? Is transporting birds a risk?
Yes. I think there was one report, and this was many years back, where they showed that taking the birds to a processing plant and they could see that it spread down the road behind them. Currently, you know, birds are not usually allowed to leave the farm once there's a case. So hopefully that's not a concern.
Let's take a call now. Jeff in Delafield is here. Hi, Jeff. Go ahead.
Yes. Good morning. Thank you. You had mentioned that influenza is more prevalent in waterfowl. And why is that? And how much of a threat is that to waterfowl populations? And the third part of the question is, as a waterfowl hunter, should we be worried about catching it or spreading it?
Thank you, Jeff.
Yeah. The virus originally, as far as we know, started in a goose population, and it does seem to be pretty common in waterfowl. For a long time, we said they wouldn't die from it, that they would just carry it, but that has not been completely true. Some of them get sick as well. So that's that. I think from a waterfowl hunter, there's a slight risk. It's really been very minimal numbers of humans that have been affected worldwide from this. But I would be a little cautious in processing them, you know, wash your hands right after and things. So there's a slight risk, but I think it's still pretty slight at this point.
Why do you think it is that avian flu rarely spreads to humans?
That's maybe getting a little past my expertise, but I think it has to do with the receptors that birds carry versus humans inside their respiratory system. But
are there any new and novel things, you know, akin to laser technology, for instance, that farmers are doing in their poultry operations to stop the spread?
Right. A lot of people are installing, a truck wash for vehicles coming into the property. Certainly a lot of more limitations on people visiting the farms than we used to have. Some use what's called a Danish entry system, where you have a barrier that you have to cross and change shoes and clothes to get to that So those are some of the common things I've heard.
So it sounds like cleanliness is very much key in trying to stop the spread of avian flu.
Yeah, we think so anyway. And it also helps with other disease spread too.
Ron, thank you so much for joining us.
Very happy to do it.
Ron Cain is a poultry specialist at UW Extension's College of Agricultural and Life Sciences as we explore new efforts to contain the spread of avian flu. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine solutions and partnerships to end hunger in the Milwaukee area through the work of the Hunger Task Force. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about leaving home and finding a new one nearby.
As the saying goes, home is where the heart is. But for writer BJ Hollers, it's a little more complicated than that. We can become deeply connected to our physical homes. So moving and moving on can be a process.
While my family and I have cherished our time in Eau Claire, it's time for us to say goodbye. The boxes are packed, the papers are signed. All that's left is to bid you farewell as we embark upon the next chapter of our journey. A journey, I'm pleased to add, that will take us no further than 1.9 miles from our current home. Yet, sentimentalist that I am, any move, even one that lands us in the same zip code, leaves me awash with emotion. Over the past month, while attempting to box up our belongings, I regularly pumped the packing brakes to indulge in various unplanned detours down memory lane, including a writing worksheet I found crumpled in my 7-year-old daughter's room shortly before our scheduled move. She'd composed several sentences about the move, including, "My house is along the highway. I've been to my new house." But then, in a stunning twist, her declarative statements veered toward the philosophical. Why does the world move so fast? The moment she got home from school, I accosted her. "Where on earth did you come up with that line?" I asked, handing her the paper. "Duh," she said, rolling her eyes, "only from every adult ever." If there's one thing adults do well, it's lamenting the fast passage of time. Unfortunately, we're less adept at finding ways to slow it. Let me be clear. I never wanted to move. Instead, I'd hoped to root myself as deeply to the land as our backyard river birch tree. But my wife had insisted that the children required bedrooms and bathrooms, and eventually, logic won the day. My begrudging agreement came with conditions. I demanded that our new house be within walking distance of our old house. I wanted to avoid all bidding wars, and I didn't want to sell our former house to just anyone. Such stringent conditions, I figured, would buy me a little more time. Instead, the universe conspired on my wife's behalf, rolling out a tailor-made red carpet that made short work of my conditions. One afternoon, the grandparents of a family friend mentioned that they were hoping to downsize. Their home was just the right size and just the right neighborhood, a mere 5,800 steps away from our current home. Within a month, we'd struck a deal. The only bidding war involved me demanding that I pay a little more to make things closer to fair. With 2 out of 3 conditions met, all that remained was finding the perfect buyers for our own home. This being a seller's market, I had the luxury of vetting all interested parties. Following an extensive 37-year process, I found the perfect people. Or rather, they found me. "Wait a minute," I said into the phone. "You mean to tell me that you and Dad would move here?" "Yes," my mother agreed. "There's nothing we want more." After missing one too many of their grandchildren's activities, my parents were anxious to make the 500-mile journey from Indiana to embark upon their own next chapter with us. Now, if this all seems a little too good to be true, it's because it is. I'm still waiting for the other shoe to drop. Will the basement flood? Will the roof cave in? Whatever the price, we'll pay it. Because we have found not only the perfect house, but the perfect arrangement too. We lose nothing, and we gain grandparents. Was it Heraclitus or my 7-year-old who said, "The only constant in life is change"? Whomever it was, they were right. While change is scary, it's less so when you know it's coming. And since it's always coming, we ought never to be afraid. When one door closes, another opens. All the better when you've got familiar faces waiting within.
BJ Hollers is a writer, author, and assistant professor of creative writing at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org, on Facebook, and on Instagram. I'm Brad Colbert.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The Hunger Task Force works alongside a network of food pantries, meal sites, and shelters to serve families facing hunger in the Milwaukee area. We learn about its partnerships that enabled the distribution of more than 9 million pounds of food last year. Call in with a question. You can add comments. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Guy Smith is Executive Director of Milwaukee County Parks. Guy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. And Matt King is here, the incoming CEO of Hunger Task Force. Matt, welcome.
Hey, good morning, Kate. Good to be here.
Good morning. So, Matt, starting with you, this marking the 50th year of the Hunger Task Force, how different is food insecurity today than in past decades, past generations?
Yeah, thanks, Kate. Yeah, so as you mentioned, Hunger Task Force is a nonprofit working to end hunger throughout Wisconsin. And we've been around for 50 years, and partnerships have really been a big part of that. So we've been really honing in on collaborations like the one with Milwaukee County Parks. And I think that's been a big evolution, is that a lot of other organizations are getting involved and taking an interest in supporting this work.
Your organization is seeing a recent rise in food insecurity across Milwaukee, and your outgoing CEO, Sherry Tesler, told a TV station recently that pantry reliance increased from about 17,000 individuals in January of 2023 to now in January 2024, more than 24,000 people. Why are more people relying on food pantries?
Well, throughout the course of the pandemic, there were resources that were available through the federal government and state government that have since sunsetted and gone away. So the end of the pandemic era benefits, as well as the increase costs that we've all been experiencing, you know, food being an obvious one, but even costs of transportation and housing have been on the rise as well. So that increase in the cost of living has been a big piece of what we're hearing from the community as to the rise in need.
Turning to you, Guy, Milwaukee County Parks having this longstanding relationship with the Hunger Task Force, how important are partnerships to ending hunger across the state?
I think partnerships are key. For Milwaukee County Parks, we're throughout all of Milwaukee County. We have 153 parks, over 15,300 acres of land, and we recognize that parks are a major part of community and community building. And we very much believe in the great work that the Hunger Task Force does and providing food, especially in the summer through summer programs at our parks, especially at our playgrounds where there's programming, food. But then one of the major initiatives that the Hunger Task Force has taken on over the past couple decades is running the farm, which is actually Milwaukee County Parkland down in Franklin. And it provides such a vital resource of nutritious food for the community. And I can't be more proud of that partnership.
We're going to get to the farm in a moment, but I want to ask you about how food distribution goes with parks in the summer. Can you explain the connection there?
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously, we want our youth to be able to be well-fed all year round. But certainly in the summer, most students, most youth are out of school. And so some of those resources are then in high demand. And so we have partnered with MPS Recreation to help program some of our playgrounds, and then Hunger Task Force and some of their partners provide lunches. And we've been able to do that at various parks. We've also been able to do that at some of our community centers within our parks. And we just, it's one of those things where we want to be sure to meet people where they're at.
I wonder then, Matt, how you're able to leverage that type of delivery system, what impact that has with the massive amounts of food you're trying to move.
Yeah, the Summer Meals Collaborative is a really critical piece to addressing childhood hunger. And that's been a key focus of our organization for 50 years. And that's how we started, was just a focus on hungry kids in Milwaukee. Summer is a time when childhood hunger is at its peak, that kids are at the most risk for childhood hunger, because kids who are otherwise dependent on summer, on school lunches and school breakfasts, maybe don't have that same access. And so the Summer Meals Collaborative really brings together, as Guy mentioned, the parks, Milwaukee Rec, the Social Development Commission, the Department of Public Instruction, Kohl's as a private funder, the Boys and Girls Clubs, YMCA, school districts like MPS, West Dallas, West Milwaukee, Salvation Army, Center for Independence, the Sheriff's Office, No Kid Hungry, USDA. So you can get the sense that this is really a massive collaboration, and it's been recognized at the federal level as a model that the USDA would like other cities and other states to emulate.
And in that massive collaboration, though, you have to consistently deliver. That food has to be there each time, and that way the people who need it can expect it. Is that difficult for you?
It's definitely complicated. But you know, feeding hungry kids is like a logistic that we have figured out at this point. A lot of the meals are reimbursable to these entities through the federal government. And so the resources are there. The logistics have been figured out, but it is essentially a year-round planning process to lead up to the summer.
Matt King is incoming CEO of Hunger Task Force. We have Guy Smith with us, who leads Milwaukee County Parks, partners with Hunger Task Force on a summer meals program in parks we've been talking about. As we discuss ways to fight hunger, call in with the question. You can share your perspective at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore new ways to address hunger in Wisconsin and partnerships of a hunger relief organization in the Milwaukee area. More than 700,000 Wisconsinites are receiving food share benefits to help pay for groceries. That's according to the State Health Department. Call in with a question. Share comments. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Matt King is incoming CEO of Hunger Task Force, which is based in West Milwaukee. Guy Smith is here, executive director of Milwaukee County Parks. Guy, the Hunger Task Force, as you mentioned, operates this 208-acre farm in the suburb of Franklin. Farm grows food for food banks around the county. How is Milwaukee County Park System involved in this operation?
Well, it's a really neat, unique relationship and a really cool project. And so Milwaukee County Parks, believe it or not, owns about 800 acres of farmland. And we lease some of those out to local farmers. Some of them are community gardens with University of Wisconsin Extension. And then we have this unique partnership with the Hunger Task Force with the farm. And so the farm utilizes, obviously, agricultural land. They also have orchards. Something that you might not be aware of, or the general public might not be aware of, is there's a beautiful oak savanna and natural area that runs along the Root River that the natural areas staff of my team, as well as the Hunger Task Force, collaborate on to help be stewards of the environment. But it's just so impressive, the high quality produce and the quantity that Matt and his team are able to provide and to be able to share amongst our community. So Milwaukee County Parks is just really proud to be part of that partnership. We recognize food insecurity being a really major issue in Milwaukee and across the state, and we want to be part of the solution.
Matt, can you talk about the aspect of the farm in your total operation of food distribution and the role of it? Yeah,
one of the consistent challenges for food banks and food pantries, not only in Milwaukee, but across the country, is access to fresh produce and reliable access to fresh produce in substantial quantities. And, you know, not just any produce, but high quality fresh produce. And we all know how expensive it is to eat healthy. And for those who are living in poverty or living on the edge of poverty, eating healthy and having access to fresh produce is a reality that they might not have. And so the farm gives us that ability to grow our own fresh produce, not be as reliant upon the ebbs and flows of donations, but rather growing our own, ensuring that it's high quality, market quality, fresh produce, which really speaks to a key aspect of our mission, which is dignity. And so we believe that when we serve people, that people should have a dignified, compassionate experience. And so the farm allows us to provide over 25 different kinds of produce. We grow over 500,000 pounds each year. And so this has become our most substantial source of fresh produce.
Is that scalable, I wonder? Is that fresh farm produce, can you still produce more, or are you at maximum capacity for that, for the farm?
No, I believe it is. And I believe it's not only scalable, but replicable. Hmm. And so I think it's an innovative concept that, you know, could be exported to other areas. So maybe Guy and I will talk more about, you know, some more of that 800 acres of farmland.
Some negotiating there. So, like, how much planting and harvest coordination and volunteerism is needed to make that farm operate at its full capacity with the fresh produce that you need in distribution?
It's a tremendous community effort. We would not be able to do it without the help of volunteers. We actually engage, just at the farm, over 5,000 community volunteers every growing season.
Wow.
So volunteers are engaged in every aspect of the farm, from planting to weeding to harvesting, washing, packing, etc. And so it's a really unique experience for people as well who may not have an agricultural background, because it's not required. They can show up, get trained, and have the experience of not only participating in a farm activity, but also giving back.
That is Matt King at Hunger Task Force. We have Guy Smith here at Milwaukee County Parks as we talk about efforts to reduce food insecurity in the Milwaukee area. Call in questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Guy, the farm is intentionally also growing culturally appropriate foods. Can you talk about that effort?
I think it's really important, and I think the Hunger Task Force has done a really good job on responding to what the public wants and needs. And I think that's great because both the Hunger Task Force as a service nonprofit and Milwaukee County Parks as a public entity, you know, it's important that we listen to our constituents or we listen to our users of our programs and things like that. And the fact that the Hunger Task Force has been able to diversify the types of crops that they're growing and their produce that they're providing, I think is just awesome. And I can tell you from personal experience, my leadership team and I have volunteered at the farm during the harvest season, and you feel a real sense of community. And I think what's really important is what Matt said, is that the Hunger Task Force does it with dignity because everyone deserves to be able to eat healthy and have high quality food. And I think collaboratively, that is what we're providing.
I wonder, Matt King, then, what could, whether it be the state, lawmakers, local area do to further the work you're doing to make it more effective and to end hunger?
Yeah, I think land access is a huge challenge, as we know, for farmers, particularly beginning farmers. And so this doesn't need to just be a nonprofit solution. We talked about the different private and public sector partners that are coming together through this work. And I think that improving access to farmland is a big piece of it. I do think that it would be beneficial to further incentivize state and local agriculture to be able to give their high quality products to food banks and hunger relief organizations as well.
Guy, through these partnerships in our closing moments together, do you view parks in a new light?
You know, that's a really good question. 5 years ago, Milwaukee County as a whole focused on doing a strategic plan and having Milwaukee County being the healthiest county in Wisconsin and ending racism. And here's the deal. The reality is that we, the Parks Department, completed our strategic plan that aligns with Milwaukee County's plan. It aligns with the Milwaukee Parks Foundation's plan. And is very similar to the type of work that we're doing with the Hunger Task Force, where we really are focused on social determinants of health and looking like parks have so many. There's mental health, there's physical health. Here we're feeding people nourishment. There's so many different aspects. So I would say yes. I would say within the last few years, our paradigm, our mindset definitely has adjusted. Certainly, we've worked with Hunger Task Force for over 20 years, but yeah, it's definitely changed.
Thank you both for joining us. Guy Smith leads Milwaukee County Parks, Matt King at Hunger Task Force. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The most recent Wisconsin Youth Risk Behavior Survey reveals 18% of Wisconsin high school students report being bullied at school. And nationwide, about one in five students say they've experienced bullying. That analysis is from the federal government's bullying prevention effort. Thanks to Scott and Wanakee and Tiffany in Blue River for suggesting we talk about bullying. And you can be part of the conversation. Call in with a question, share comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Libby Strunz is a school mental health consultant with the Department of Public Instruction, part of its Student Services Prevention and Wellness team. Libby, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So explain to us how your team supports Wisconsin schools with this issue.
Thanks, Kate. There is lots that the Student Services Prevention and Wellness team is doing to provide resources and professional learning with the goal of reducing bullying in Wisconsin. So one resource that we have released for schools within the last year is our Bullying Prevention Toolkit. And this is developed in partnership with Dr. Chad Rose and the University of Missouri Bully Prevention Lab. I know we'll be hearing from Dr. Rose in just a bit. And this toolkit serves as a resource for schools who are working to implement and strengthen their comprehensive approach to bullying prevention and response. So I will note that it's a guidance document. It's not a mandated resource. And the toolkit has a couple of different parts. So the first part provides guidance for schools on bullying prevention practices. So this can include educating students and staff and caregivers about bullying, establishing a bullying prevention task force or team of people at the school who are dedicated to this work, and then also creating a bullying prevention action plan. And we also know, and the toolkit encourages, that all of this work can be integrated into existing school climate and behavioral work that a school is doing. And then that second part of the toolkit provides resources for bullying response, because we know that it's very important for schools to have clear and consistent reporting and investigation procedures.
And so between the prevention and the response, those pieces in this toolkit are really supposed to address this issue. Can you give us, how much do schools grapple with? Is it just, some schools and not others, or do all schools really have this issue?
I think, unfortunately, it's accurate to say that schools across our state and schools across our nation and truly schools across our world struggle with bullying. And that's why both parts of that toolkit are really important, because we know that no matter how hard we work to prevent and reduce bullying, there will still be cases of bullying that occur. So it's really important that schools respond in a way that's equitable and consistent and involves students and families.
The Department of Public Instruction says students must have a clear understanding of what bullying is and the difference between peer conflict and bullying. How does your team help schools distinguish?
Great question. So that information is covered in our Bullying Prevention Toolkit. It's also covered in some of the other resources we have on our website. So we have a module series, a learning series for educators that is also done in partnership with Dr. Chad Rose. I know he's going to be talking more about that in a bit. And we also have a recorded webinar series that's available. And we also do in-person conference presentations throughout the state with some of the professional organizations that reach educators. So we work to get that message out so that educators and caregivers and students can all have a clear idea of what's bullying and what's not.
Libby Strenz is with us, school mental health consultant at the State Department of Public Instruction, as we talk about bullying prevention and response. Call in questions and comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Libby, we heard from Tina in Milwaukee, who called in and asked if the ways that adults treat each other, if that affects students and prevents or encourages bullying behavior.
Absolutely. And I think that one thing that's important to understand about bullying prevention is that it's most effective in the context of larger school climate work. So when we talk about bullying prevention, we're not just talking about implementing a specific curriculum, although there's certainly excellent bullying prevention curriculums out there, but we're also talking about creating a school climate where there is a sense of safety and support, where kids feel belonging and empowerment, where they have strong relationships with trusting, caring educators, and where they see those educators and other adults in their life treating one another with respect. So one thing that I want to share is that our team's work on bullying prevention, it doesn't exist in isolation. So For example, our team does work also on social emotional learning, or SEL, and research consistently supports that SEL programs can effectively reduce bullying behaviors by promoting social emotional competence amongst both students and adults, fostering positive relationships, and working to create a supportive school environment. So I absolutely think that adult behavior and the school climate in general is an important factor in reducing bullying overall.
I wonder, what if a parent or a caregiver isn't aware that the bullying behavior is going on in their child? I mean, is there a disconnect in communication about bullying?
So that's one thing that we encourage, and there's actually a set of specific resources in the Bullying Prevention Toolkit designed to engage families and caregivers, because that's another really essential part of our bullying prevention and response work. So there's lots of ways that schools can engage caregivers and families, helping to educate them about what bullying is, how they report bullying if their child is experiencing that, and really making sure that they're engaged throughout that process, because sometimes there is a disconnect between school and home, and a parent might not be aware of what's going on. And there's a couple resources that I would point parents towards that are really helpful in staying engaged. We have some on our DPI bullying prevention webpage. And the easiest way to access that webpage, which is where the toolkit is also located, is to go to the DPI website and use that search bar at the top and just search bullying prevention, and it will take you to that page. So that has some resources for parents that are part of that bullying prevention toolkit. It has some resources for parents to guide them through what they can do if their child is experiencing bullying. And another resource that I really strongly recommend to caregivers and parents is stopbullying.gov. Mm. It has a wide variety of resources. It's written in a way that's accessible to students and to caregivers. And it includes some things like having conversations with your student about their school day and recognizing warning signs that bullying might be occurring, so that it increases the chance that parents are having those conversations and are aware if their child is being bullied at school.
Let's bring in Mark in Milwaukee. Mark, go ahead with your question.
Oh, thank you so much, Kate, for dealing with such an important issue. Sometimes we lose sight of the ways in which the news stories that you're reporting are connected. For example, we're talking about bullying, and the news story before that was about the unfortunate police officers who had abused those two men. And sometimes the bullies are the ones who grow up to become, bully-in-chief, so to speak. My question for your guest is, you talked about many tools in the toolkit for the that set out things like rules for reporting and investigating bullying. But what about for the amelioration of the situation, for punishment or repercussions that can try to stop things? Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Libby, go ahead.
That's a great question, Mark. And our state statute on bullying does not require school districts to respond in a specific way to bullying. School districts are required to have a bullying prevention policy in place, but how they respond to that is a local control decision. And what we recommend can vary case to case, but in some cases, it can be helpful for a school district to provide not just consequences, but social emotional education for those students who are engaging in bullying. Oftentimes, a student who's engaging in bullying might have deficits in those competencies, those social emotional competencies that are causing them to act in ways that are not pro-social with their peers. And so going beyond just providing consequences and working with that student to build skills in peer relationships are really important, because Mark, as you said, we know that there can be long-term consequences, not just for students who are bullied, but students who engage in bullying. So we want to help them to build skills and prevent that behavior from happening in the future.
Libby, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Libby Strenz is a school mental health consultant at Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction. We continue this conversation ahead, exploring a bullying prevention training course for Wisconsin educators. Call in with a question. Share your perspective, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore new strategies in bullying prevention training and interventions. Call in with a question, share thoughts, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Chad Rose is an associate professor in the Department of Special Education at University of Missouri, director of the MISU Ed Bully Prevention Lab, delivering its training course in Wisconsin. Chad, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Your lab examining best practices to prevent and respond to bullying. Your research also focusing on bullying among students with disabilities. What are you learning?
So we're learning a lot. We started this work really just trying to understand bullying and why kids engage in bullying and the outcomes associated with it. And so probably the biggest takeaway that we have is our findings have suggested that kids with social and communication skill deficits tend to have the highest likelihood of being involved in bullying.
And so, you know, you have put together a training course. Can you talk a bit about what it entails?
For sure. So the training course was developed because there are a number of states that require training for educators according to their state legislation. And so what we're doing was trying to meet those demands and also provide educators with sound instruction in relation to bullying prevention. So the training includes four modules. The first module is really what bullying is. The definitions, predictive and protective factors, warning signs. And then the next three modules, we really get into interventions, and we start our interventions at the foundation. And that means we talk about climate assessments, identifying youth who may be at greater risk. Then we talk about what we do at the school level for all students. Then we get into targeted instruction for youth who may need support in specific skill areas. And then we get into individualized interventions that are related to those kids that may engage in high rates of bullying behavior or those youth who may experience high victimization.
What is the role of youth here, of the kids, peer involvement and their interactions or being a bystander versus adults intervening and applying, you know, the things they've learned?
For sure. So one thing that I have to note first is bullying is a social construct, meaning that bullying happens within these social environments. And so peers play a critical role in that. And so part of what we talk about in the modules is kids need to know what to do, what to say, and who to tell when they witness or experience bullying. And that's the charge of the school and the local district in determining kind of the protocol for teaching peers what to do, what to say, and who to tell. But that's the crux of the foundation of any bullying prevention programs. Now, educators, in addition to a lot of what Libby said, educators are responsible for knowing how to respond to the victimization, how to address the bullying itself, and also having strategies in relation to protecting reporters who do want to make reports but are afraid to.
Can you talk further about that, protecting reporters and, you know, encouraging what happens when, you know, the student is actively defending someone who's being bullied? I mean, could that in itself produce adverse outcomes for the victim and the person who is trying to protect that person?
It is possible. I think schools that approach bullying prevention through a social emotional lens, and really focus on social and communication skills and reinforcing these skills, have a higher likelihood of reducing bullying mm-hmm. within their schools. Also, schools, and this is included in the toolkit that's available, schools should have clear reporting mechanisms that allow students to make reports in various different ways. They should be able to make anonymous reports if they don't feel comfortable in disclosing who they are. Schools could use electronic reporting procedures, and teachers should be trained in how to interview a student if a student wants to make an oral report. And so it really is a combination of setting a school climate that is designed to, you know, support student development in relation to bullying reduction, as well as making sure teachers are aware of what to do.
Talking with Chad Rose, who leads Wisconsin's online bullying prevention training course for educators. Call in questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Chad, you know, our teens live so much of their lives on their phones these days. What effect does this training have on cyberbullying?
Yeah, cyberbullying is an interesting topic, and we've been exploring it quite frequently. And one thing people should know is that involvement in social media and online interactions is a part of youth's daily socialization.
Mm-hmm.
And so really youth can't distinguish how they socialize in physical or virtual spaces. And so what we really do is we talk to schools in understanding digital citizenship and training digital citizenship in schools. And that is not only keeping kids safe online and what safety actually means, but it's also teaching kids choice making and responsible decision making in online spaces, but then also recognizing the permanency of what they do and what they post online.
Can you measure the effectiveness of the training that you're able to offer educators?
We can, and we've done something similar in other states, in other districts, and we have measured it. And what we're seeing is an increase in knowledge and skills among educators, but also an increase in self-efficacy in knowing what to do in situations where they receive bullying reports.
You know, what can educators do to create that safe environment, that positive climate for students to be willing to feel comfortable and come forward and report bullying?
Yeah, I think Libby hit the nail on the head when she was discussing social and emotional learning. I'm an advocate for social and emotional learning. I'm an advocate for embedding social and communication skills into the daily curriculum. I believe that if we start to look at the socialization of our youth as just as important as we do the academic achievement of our youth, then we would establish a stronger and more supportive climate. Because while academics are incredibly important, how we socialize when we leave school is just as important for lifelong success.
Chad, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Chad Rose is director of the MISU Ed Bully Prevention Lab. It works with the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction to offer this free online bullying prevention training course for Wisconsin educators. We turn next to an elementary school principal sharing strategies on creating a school environment that helps prevent bullying behavior. And you can call in with a question, share your thoughts along the way. The number is 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Thanks to Tiffany in Blue River and Scott in Wanakee for suggesting we discuss bullying. An elementary school principal compares bullying to a type of contagious virus. When left unattended, a child being bullied may one day use bullying behavior themselves. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Kathleen Corley is principal of Red Cedar Elementary School in Bluffton, South Carolina. New book is called The Magical Place We Call School, Creating a Safe Space for Learning and Happiness in a Challenging World. Kathleen, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much. I appreciate being here.
So as principal of an elementary school with about 600 students, how do you view your role?
Chief construction cone mover, motivator, safety officer, facilitator, pretty much anything I can do to make sure the teachers have what they need so that they can meet students' needs.
How does that impact the environment of your school and the climate there?
Our teachers here, I believe, know that I will support them in what they try to do. Sometimes you hear from teachers in other schools around the country who say, I would like my classroom environment to be different. I would like for discipline to be tightened up. But if I try to do anything that is beyond what has been done before and get the same results, I may not have the backing of my principal, which means I'm vulnerable to whatever some parents might think is too much for their children, or I'm expecting too much. So it, as long as I'm supporting the teachers, they're able to do what they need to do, including discipline and letting administration know when something has gotten too far and we need to fix it.
You say that the magic happens in the classroom, and as you support your teachers, how do you create magic at school while also addressing and eliminating bullying behavior?
When students are engaged in what's going on in the classroom, that is, if it's not boring, they're far more likely to be attending to what's going on at school. We remind them every now and again. I write on everyone's report card, and I write quite a bit on their report cards, all 656 of them, that, you know, you come to school to learn. That is your job. So let's keep them all about their job as much as possible, but let's make it entertaining. Let's make it exciting. And our teachers want it that way. They can't wait to uncover something for their students. So that the teachers here make learning exciting as much as possible.
One of the students you bring up in the book is a child you name Matthew, and you discuss the importance of understanding the emotional needs of children, and you share the story of the second grader, Matthew, who you see push another student on school grounds. What has Matthew's behavior taught you?
That was my first year as a principal, and Matthew was a new student, and he made it so that he was trying to tell his parents that being in the third school in his short career, that he just couldn't take it. And I didn't recognize as much as I needed to recognize at the time. He pushed a child in front of a bus just as the bus was about to leave. The bus driver stopped the bus. That wasn't a problem. I grabbed the child. That wasn't a problem. But I was dumbfounded by what Matthew was doing. Basically, when we figured it out, what Matthew was trying to say is, I'm tired of leaving schools that I don't want to leave, and I can't do this anymore. So what I'm going to do, since you won't keep me with my friends, I'm going to make it so that no one likes me here and I won't have any friends. So whenever I do leave here, I won't care. It's not going to be a thing.
As you work through this with the parents, what would you have done differently in the situation?
When I talked with the parents, they didn't seem to think that was such a big deal that their son was having a problem with separating from other children in those schools. So, I didn't push it. I needed to push it, but as a first-year principal, I just didn't. They were very casual about it. Oh, he doesn't really care. Well, I get the sense, Mom and Dad, that and he told me that you said you would keep him in touch with the kids in his old school. Yeah, well, that that wasn't a big deal. We know that wasn't a thing. It didn't really matter. I think it mattered to him, and that's as far as I went with it. But what I do now is, Mom and Dad, please remember that children have almost no say in when there is going to be a move, and you're doing all the decision making. They're not.
We're talking with South Carolina elementary school principal Kathleen Corley. New book is called The Magical Place We Call School, as we discuss bullying prevention intervention efforts. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. Let's explore a cyberbullying incident that happened at school. And you write that third grade teachers set up an online chat room for 90 third graders. What happened there?
The chat room was part of an educational program. So what they were supposed to be doing was discussing the projects that were posed through that application. And that's what they did do when they were third graders. And the third grade teachers were, of course, monitoring it. Then they became fourth graders. And the third grade teachers forgot to take down that chat room. The students discovered it and went dark very quickly. It seems like they don't know what to say to each other. We find this with high school age students as well. There are students who will text in a very nasty way, especially in a group chat, make fun of someone in the group, and they will sit next to those same students and have no issues with them whatsoever. They'll be friends. Hmm. And it's almost like they're playing a game, but there are some children who are affected by that. No matter if you and I are 10 years old and I say something nasty about you, you say something nasty about me, there are five other people in the chat, somebody's still going to feel some kind of way about that. Mm-hmm. Even if we're doing a project together, even if we live next door to each other and we play together at times, someone's going to feel hurt, as well they should, because when you make fun of someone, when you talk down to them, call them names, it's very hard to emerge from that unscathed. So when we come upon issues like that, among other things that we do is restorative justice, where the two people face each other and talk about what just happened, because the facing each other part doesn't happen in the chat. And I think that's a giant part of this. When they face each other and talk about what happened, and they see each other's eyes, and sometimes I'll draw attention to, look in Thomas's eyes right now. What do you see in his eyes? He's mad? I think maybe that, but what else? He's sad. Yes, he is, and you did that. And it's hard to undo it, but you can make it better by talking with him about it. Tell him what you were doing.
Do you have them read the critical comments they wrote while looking at the victim?
Sometimes, especially the older children, fourth and fifth grade. We're pre-kindergarten to fifth grade here.
I want to talk more about restorative justice because we often think about it connected to the justice system. And do you see a place for these types of approaches in the elementary school setting?
Yes, absolutely. Some people think that restorative justice means a lack of consequences. Sometimes a child will be suspended for something if that's what the discipline code calls for, but they'll also be involved in restorative justice because we need to make everybody whole here. We can't get beyond a thing just with the consequences. I need to know, we need to know that everyone can move on from the problem.
And how much do apologies matter in that moment when they're all sitting in a small group?
They do matter. Most often we have students write a reflection about what they did. And if they're very small children, there are, I hate to say it, worksheets that have pictures of unhappy faces, et cetera, that where they can draw pictures adjacent to those already printed pictures to express their apology. So first they're writing the reflection. This is what I did. This is what I could have done. This is what I'm going to do going forward. And then the apology, sometimes written, always spoken to the child with one of us sitting there.
Kathleen Corley is an elementary school principal in Bluffton, South Carolina. New book explores ways to develop a positive culture inside schools. Call in with a question, share your thoughts, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about efforts to create a positive culture and learning environment at school that may help prevent bullying behavior. Kathleen Corley is an elementary school principal in South Carolina. New book is called The Magical Place We Call School. Call in with a question. Add your comments. 800-642-1234. Tyrone in Milwaukee is here. Hi, Tyrone. Go ahead.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for taking my call. Good morning, Miss Kathleen. Good morning.
Good morning, Tyrone.
Yes. Good morning. Thank you for the subject and the opportunity. Good morning, Milwaukee. Good morning, Wisconsinites. Yes, Tyrone W. speaking, northwest side of Milwaukee. A couple different things there. And a wonderful Good Friday, Resurrection Sunday, Palm Sunday to everyone and their family. God bless, be blessed, be well to all. Oh, man. Well, I'll tell you, it's sad. You know, what direction do the children have to go in when they have no outlet or release there? I mean, they've gone to the principal, they've gone to the counselor, they've gone to the teacher, and they feel their hands are tied. They have nowhere else to turn. Illustration would be some of these universities, and I'm assuming that bullying and what's it called there, hazing are pretty much one and the same, but on different levels. And these parents, they're paying their children to go to these universities and these colleges, and these sororities are doing this hazing and stuff there, and you have actually people dying behind this stuff here. So it seems to me like it's on a different level from bullying to hazing and on and on. But where does the individual have to turn when they say, well, I'm in this sorority, but I can't go to anybody because I've got to do this thing here that's a ritual. But they're beating me, they're hazing me, just like the band member on the bus there. He got from the back of the bus there, he died before he could get to the front of the bus.
Tyrone, thank you so much for calling in and for sharing those difficult words. Kathleen, one piece of this is if a child is not being heard, not being believed, but also what happens when there is that peer pressure as well?
We have to get to the peer pressure. If you're talking about let's all go harass this person, peer pressure. And I think that's where you're going. Yes?
I think so. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
This will be fun to harass Jonathan. we teach students in our counseling classes. We have classroom counseling where the counselor goes to each class to teach at their level how you stand up with someone. You don't stop a fight necessarily physically, but you use your words to stand up to the bully. Good example, there were two brothers who happened to witness another child who goes to our school at the baseball diamond put his sunglasses down and he walked away. By the time he came back, another child who does not go to our school took the sunglasses. The boy who owned them came back and said, "Hey, those are mine, give them back." And the other child said, "Not anymore, they're mine now." The other two boys said, "No, that's not right." They were watching from afar. They walked up and said, "No, those belong to Anderson. You give them back now. It's not right for you to take them." The other boy considered it for a while and gave them back. It doesn't always end that way, but we reward students for doing things like that. We have a book vending machine. You can earn a gold coin to put in the book vending machine. 2 days ago, those boys got coins because they did that. The whole of the neighborhood, the whole of the classroom, the whole of the school, the whole of all the parents need to be on the same side when it comes to this. They need to be looking out for what is right and be ready to stand up for what is right. To Tyrone's question about who do you report this to? Every college, every university, every school district has to have, by law, appropriate means for reporting bullying or dealing with bullying based on the state laws. So we have an app called See Something, Say Something. Kids use it. Usually it's not bullying. It's just somebody being annoying, which is different than bullying, but we handle it as though it's bullying. When we get a See Something, Say Something notice, our superintendent gets it, and four other people at district office who are there only for this purpose. So, and at colleges and universities, yes, the fraternity, sorority, hazing part seems to be dying a slow, slow, ever too slow death. And it's unfortunate that it's taking so long for it to be extinguished. That is not what we deal with, obviously, in an elementary school, but the seeds can certainly be planted. Yeah, it's my right to do this to somebody else. No, it is not your right. Mm-hmm. You do not have the right to mess with somebody else. In the morning, the last thing I say on announcements, ask good questions, make good decisions, leave things better than the way you found them, especially people's hearts, and always show respect. I think it gets through.
Mm.
Not positive, but they act like it does.
Thank you for sharing that. Barry in Viroqua is here with a question. Barry, go ahead.
Yes, I just want to make a comment that with the issues that you're discussing and the last caller, we are facing so many social-emotional behavioral issues in schools that affect the future lives of just millions and millions of people. And the way we handle most of that in schools these days is through punishment. And it's not that people shouldn't be held accountable, but punishment, as research points out, doesn't really work that well. And what I would like to suggest to parents and communities is that to really develop healthy individuals, we ought to have two adults in every classroom from kindergarten through fourth grade, thereby providing the kinds of support, tenderness, loving, caring, et cetera, that a single teacher, given the
constraints,
social and behavioral today. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Barry. Kathleen, what do you make of that?
Barry's right on the mark. In our situation, we have small class sizes that are maybe between 18 and 20. The state law is 30. We can't go over 30. We would never in these days have 30. Kindergarten teachers, kindergarten and pre-K teachers have assistants, and the kindergarten assistants are shared with first grade. Second, third, fourth, and fifth do not have assistants, but there are additional people who do assist. Our support staff has interventionists for reading and for math and tutors. And most often those folks are in the classroom along with the teachers. We have a high Hispanic population, second language population, about 45%. And those students have additional help from, now they're called multilingual teachers. The names change, ESL, ESOL, over time, but they are to support those students in learning English and the rest of their subjects. The support people are important, and the class size is important, because Barry's right that there are children with many different emotional issues, and they need to be addressed. So they have individualized education plans that we follow with special needs teachers and other interventionists to help. In the old one-size-fits-all days, where the teacher sort of stood at the front of the classroom and taught, and the children were to take all of that in, and if they got it, that's great, and if they didn't, well, maybe the teacher helps them at recess.
That's not
those days.
They're over. And Kathleen, we're out of time, but thank you for joining us. Kathleen Corley, principal at Red Cedar Elementary School, new book, The Magical Place We Call School. I'm Kate Archer Kent. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network.